This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Last Thursday, I had the chance to speak to Dame Jane Morris Goodall, primatologist and anthropologist and founder of the Jane Goodall Institute and the Roots and Shoots program. Dr. Jane Goodall is, of course, considered to be the world's foremost expert on chimpanzees, and her extensive research into the behavior of chimpanzees, which first started in Africa in the 1960s, is said to have fundamentally altered scientific thinking about the relationship between humans and other mammals. These days, aged 85, she spends about 300 days out of the year traveling the world to raise money for her institute and its affiliates, but mostly to raise awareness and promote environmental conservation. So she was doing just that during her current trip to Malaysia, where, among other things, she gave a series of talks for Roots and Shoots Malaysia. And I had the chance to hear her speak at the International Social Wellbeing Conference 2019, which was organized by the Employees Provident Fund. And later at that same conference, I managed to have a one-on-one chat with her. So here is that conversation where she shares her journey of going from naturalist to activist, her work with the world's youth to address the climate crisis, and how she stays hopeful in even these most trying of times. So, Dr. Jane, when you were working in Gombe, you attributed personalities to chimps, of course, which at the time was very controversial. But when you were there, did you immediately recognize these distinctive personalities among the chimpanzees?
Well, as for the first few months, they ran away every time they saw me. I knew nothing about them, really, except vanishing backsides. Not quite true, because I had binoculars, and I found a peak, and I could look out to the opposite slope. And I saw them feeding in the tree. I learned something about their sounds and the foods they were eating. Mm-hmm. And it was only after the one chimpanzee, David Greybeard, began to lose his fear. And, you know, gradually I could get closer. And then if he was in a group that was ready to run, and he just sat there calmly, and he was a real leader. Mm-hmm. Not the top male, but the others looked up to him. He was gentle and wise. And I suppose they thought, well, she can't be so frightening after all.
And that was the game changer, wasn't it?
It was a game changer. As soon as I could get among them, see the same one day after day and gave them names, then, of course, the difference in personality, just like with people.
And, of course, studies came out later that basically vindicated all your research. But at the time, how did you deal with that criticism? And, you know, whether that storm that... It was quite a bad storm that you were in.
Well, as I never wanted to be a scientist, as I just wanted to learn about chimps and police, Dr. Leakey, my mentor, and for my own, you know, I'm becoming more and more fascinated to find out about their social life and how long they live and how the babies develop and you know, finding out that the young ones stay with the mother till they're 8 or 9. So when there was this sort of, well, why should we believe her? Geographic only is funding her because she's got nice legs. And all this, you know, I let it
roll
over me because I was out in the field. It was Leakey who said I had to get a degree to get my own money. Mm-hmm. So once I got the degree, then I was in a slightly better position with the scientific community.
But what, for you, you know, I mean, once all of that was done, what is some of your fondest memories from your time in Gombe and in Tanzania?
Well, of course, I still go back
of course.
From time to time, but it's not the same at all, and I don't know the chimps anymore because mm-hmm. the ones I knew have gone. But my best memories, old Flo, the dominant female, and at first she was scared like everybody else. But when she trusted me enough to let her precious little four-month-old baby, who was just beginning to totter, come up and touch my nose... She kept her hand around him. She had a little worried expression on her face. But that was he looked up with these big eyes and just reached out. It was such a special moment.
It's amazing. Mm. So then, as you mentioned, you know, you don't get to spend that much time. So why did you go from naturalist to activist? And, you know, how important is it to you to have this opportunity to speak truth to power?
Well, it began when I helped put together a conference in 1986. By then, there were 7 different field sites in different parts of Africa. Mm-hmm. We put the conference together to learn more about chimp behavior in different environments, how much behavior would be consistent chimp, and was there something like culture, which I believe, which is true, young ones observing and imitating and practicing.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we had a session on conservation. And it was a shock everywhere where people were studying chimps. There was destruction of the forest. They reported declining chimp numbers. Some of them were losing their study animals to poaching. There was the bushmeat trade, the commercial. And, you know, some countries love eating chimp, thinks it's very special.
Yeah.
And mothers being shot to steal their babies to sell overseas as pets, locally as pets for entertainment, zoos, and in those days, medical research. So at the end of that conference, where there was also a session on some of the things done to chimps in captivity, medical research being the worst. I mean, our closest relatives share 98.6% of our DNA. Who can be happy and sad, who knows fear and despair, who can mourn the dead.
Yeah.
And in 5-foot by 5-foot cages alone, these very social beings, they couldn't sleep. It was secretly filmed video. Mm-hmm. And so I went to the conference as a scientist with my PhD, and I left as an activist. People say, how did you make that decision? It wasn't a decision I made. It was something that clicked in my brain.
It just had to be done.
Yeah, it had to be done. I didn't know what to do, but anyway, I had to do something.
And look at you now, you've been doing this, traveling 300 days a year, continuously doing this. But you know, 1 million species are in danger of extinction. How optimistic are you about our chances of this decline in biodiversity?
Well, it depends on us. I believe there is still a window of time.
Mm-hmm.
But we have major problems to solve if we want to maintain the biodiversity of the planet, the ecosystems. We have to realize, first of all, we're part of the natural world. We depend on the forests and the ocean for the service. I don't like that word, but the services they provide,
mm-hmm.
clean air, clean water. And, we have to solve poverty, because you cut down the last trees in your desperate effort to grow food to survive.
Mm-hmm.
You fish the last fishes to feed yourself and your family. And in towns, you buy the cheapest food. You can't afford to say, did it harm the environment or was it cruel to animals, because you have to live.
Yeah.
So we have to solve poverty. We have to do something about our unsustainable lifestyles. Almost everybody I know has more than they need, including me. And some people are way over the top, you know. And then
obscenely
we have
so.
To think about the growth of human populations.
Mm-hmm.
With 7.2 billion people on the planet now and already using up natural resources in some places faster than nature can replenish them.
Yeah.
And in 2050, it's predicted there'll be 9.7 billion. I don't think the planet can cope. Certainly not if we carry on as we are now.
Yes, but you know, getting that message across that we can't have infinite growth on a finite planet, you know, that is something very hard to swallow, especially for our world leaders. You know, they say that we need to have economic growth. You know, we need to, as you said, feed the people.
Yes, the GDP is so
important. GDP
is
so important. And, you know, how do we even begin to change those mindsets?
Well, we certainly can introduce new mindsets to young people in our Roots and Shoots program that's working. And you see it all over the world now. You know, we're in 60 countries. Young people who are actually doing things right and standing up for their own future,
mm-hmm.
because we've been stealing their future.
That's right.
Well, some of those young people have parents who are in big business, and they influence their parents. I know it because I've talked to people who've been influenced. Some of them have parents in politics.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be changed by their kids. So, you know, I take my message around and people listen to it. and tell me they're going to do things a bit differently. Mm-hmm. They've got new ways of thinking. Mm-hmm. Working with the kids so that they can go out and do their part.
And that is a major focus of your work, isn't it? Working with the children. And are you seeing them coming up with sort of different solutions and, you know, I guess more aware of how we've stolen their future, to steal your words as well? Are you seeing more awareness of that?
Yep, definitely. Yeah. Young people, they really, some of them come up with really innovative ideas, which will mean less harm to the environment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, with the new technology, they're just going to be moving with these bright young minds, thinking in the right way,
yeah,
make solutions.
Do you also agree that with climate change as a planetary scale threat, you know, and as such, it requires planetary scale reforms? So that can only be implemented by the world's government. So there's this argument now going that by asking individuals to bear the burden of the climate crisis, it sort of shifts the responsibilities from those who are actually meant to protect and those who are, you know, to be protected. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's these are problems which have to be solved. Mm-hmm. I can't solve all the problems.
No.
I can point out that they can be solved by different people in different disciplines who have the right knowledge or the right kind of brain. Because, you know, some people who make it up to the top, especially in IT, they're kind of, as children, a lot of them are dyslexic, mm-hmm. A lot of them don't go through college, and yet they've got these amazing brains for particular aspects.
That's right.
And they haven't always used their brains in the right way. But, you know, with increased awareness, this planet is in jeopardy.
Yeah.
Life as we know it. And the young people obviously are going to be more concerned. The older ones think, oh, well, it'll last me. I'll be all right for my lifetime. I don't care about the rest.
Precisely.
But the young people don't think that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we don't give them hope that there are solutions which they're going to help to find, then they won't bother either. So what's the point?
That's right. So maintaining that message of hope, that's really, really important, isn't it? And, you know, one of the things that the Jingle Institute also focuses on is, I mean, not only the environment, but education, sustainable agriculture, water management, microcredit for women, family planning. Why are all these things also important? Why did you choose to focus on these issues?
Well, I think it was in the rainforest that I learned how everything's interconnected. Everything has a role to play. Basically, if you solve one problem, it tends to lead to another problem. If you solve just one problem and these other problems that are all around you are not being solved, there's no point in solving one problem. So you need to have this holistic approach. And, you know, people said at the beginning when we were working in Africa, and they were saying, well, you can't do it all. You've got to choose. You can't do education and health and environment. I'm saying, well, what's the point of educating people if the environment is by that time destroyed? There's no point in it.
Mm-hmm.
What's the point in, you know, doing one without doing it all? And it's worked. So I think this, our Take Care to Kari program, we're about to scale it up across Africa because it works. Because all these people, the villagers, the local communities, that we involve them, we give them the tools to look after their own future.
Mm-hmm.
They come up with amazing ideas themselves as to how they can make a livelihood without destroying the environment.
I just want to pivot a little bit and talk about your mother, who I know influenced you so much. And I know you've said before that the world needs lots of little Janes as well. And I was wondering if you could just share how your mother, you know, influenced you to become the person that you are.
Well, she supported who I was. I think children, they seem to be born. I mean, my sister and me couldn't be more different.
Mm.
The same mother. And, you know, I think the important thing is for mothers to support who their children are, unless there's bad behavior, which obviously has to be, you know, changed, possible.
Yep.
But, I mean, my mother never used any, she never slapped us. It was much worse. What she did, if she didn't like what we were doing, she'd be totally silent And she'd walk around the room, pick things up and put them down. It was terrifying.
But my favorite story, which you always share, is of the earthworms, and I wonder if you could share that as well.
Well, yes, she found I was 1.5, and I was in bed, and I'd taken all the wriggly earthworms, and of course, earth, and, you know, lots of mothers, ugh, throw them out. But she just said, if you leave them here, they'll die. So we took them together out into the garden. But an even better story was when I was 4.5, we lived in London, so not so many animals. This animal-loving little girl. She took me for a holiday onto a farm, proper farm, not one of these terrible factory farms. Cows, pigs, horses out in the fields. Job to collect hen's eggs. I was given that job. And there were about 8 little hen houses where they slept at night, and they pecked around in the farmyard. And so I was going around each day with my little basket and putting the eggs in the basket. And apparently, I began asking everybody, but where's the hole where the egg comes out? I couldn't see such a hole. And nobody told me. Right. So what I remember vividly is seeing this hen. She was brown, and she was going into one of these hen houses. And I must have thought, ah, she's going to lay an egg. So I crawled after her. And of course, I can still feel her wing hitting me. She flew out with squawks of, you know, you don't want 4-year-old children crawling after you when you're going to lay an egg.
Of course.
So she sounded frightened. So again, in that little brain, I must have thought, well, no hen will lay an egg in this hen house. It's frightening. Mm-hmm. So I waited, and apparently I was gone 4 hours, waited in an empty hen house. And the hen came in, and she just positioned herself so I could see the egg coming out. And, you know, my mother by this time had called the police because they couldn't find me and it was getting late. And then this excited little girl, so many mothers would grab the child, how dare you go off without telling, where the hell have you been? But she saw my shining eyes and sat down to listen to the story of how a hen lays an egg. So the reason I love that story, isn't that the making of a little scientist? Curiosity, asking questions, not getting the right answer, deciding to find out for yourself, making a mistake, not giving up, and learning patience. A different mother might have crushed that, and I might not have done what I've done.
That is an amazing story, and I hope, you know, I mean, I'm a mother of 2 young ones as well, and, you know, that's something I hope to do as well, you know, just encourage them to be themselves, yeah, and to not, you know, squash that natural curiosity that they have. A lot of people also, it's very easy to get depressed with everything that's happening around us, right? You know, world leaders don't seem to be getting on board with this, with understanding that it is a climate crisis. I mean, some of our world leaders are climate crisis deniers. What would you like to say to people to maintain that hope and that, you know, there is something still worth fighting for and we're not too late?
I think what I say to people who are so depressed about what's going on, and we are living in very dark times, environmentally and socially, there's no question. They swing to the far right, but what I say to them is, you know, there still is hope, and I give them my reasons for hope. The human brain, the energy and inventiveness of young people when they understand the problems, and we listen to them and we empower them to take action, and how nature is resilient. I've been to places that were once completely destroyed by us. Lake Erie in the US was a fire hazard. A fire burned for a week. Now it's so clean. You could more or less drink the water and the fish had come back. And Gombe at one time was surrounded by hills from which all the forests had been cut down by more people living there than the land could support.
Yeah.
But once we found alternative ways for them to make a living without destroying the environment, all the trees are back.
Mm-hmm.
Animals on the brink of extinction, given another chance. And, you know, nature is so resilient. And then there's this indomitable spirit of people who tackle what seems to be impossible and won't give up.
There is something I know that you speak about as well, and people like David Attenborough as well, they speak about it, that how people are so disconnected from the environment as well. You know, they're so caught up with their lives and they don't, yeah, they're disconnected, you know. And how would you encourage people to reconnect with what's important?
one of the key aspects of our Roots and Shoots program, when it's in the city and, you know, kids who spend all their time looking at little screens, is to get them into nature. The younger you can do it, the better. So that's why I love our preschool and kindergarten groups, because to see the excitement, I mean, you can do very simple things that we used to do. You have a glass jar and you put some kind of absorbent paper around the edge and you fill it with sawdust or earth or whatever and keep it damp. Mm-hmm. And you put a seed between the paper and the glass, and to see children, they watch the little roots come and they watch the little shoot. You could put it upside down and then the little shoot will turn around and the little roots will turn around. And it's just simple things like that. Mm-hmm. And one little boy, you know, so often children are told not to mess about in the dirt by their parents. Mm-hmm. Children would all mess about in the dirt if you give them the chance.
Of course.
And this little boy came to see us. He was 2 years old and he'd got this snail. He was watching the snail. The snail was crawling along stone and he was watching it and watching it. Suddenly he picked it up, took it inside, or maybe he didn't, but anyway, he put it on the window pane and then ran round the other side to see what was going on. Well, I mean, that's a 2 year old.
You know,
so it seems to give children the chance to be in nature. And I took one group of inner city kids, they were all African Americans, mm-hmm. very poor part of Baltimore, I think. And they'd never been to the nearby river before. And at first it was, you know, then we gave them a little net. And they were, you know, pulling things out. And we'd taken a microscope down there. And they looked at these little tiny things and saw them under the microscope. And, you know, within 15 minutes, they were absolutely hooked. And in fact, the oldest of them, 18, he said, I want to get involved in this program. I want to go around the other schools. I want to get other kids to see this because it'll change them. It's changed me, he said.
It's amazing.
So that's why Roots and Shoots are so special to me.
Mm-hmm. I guess just approaching it in whatever different ways that we can, right? And just finding ways that we can connect to and then doing something about it. And
yes,
just
that's it. And also, you know, let's face it, there's too many people on the planet. But at least we can say, well, there's so many people, there's bound to be so many interested in this and that and that and the other, and out of this will come some brilliant invention. I mean, I've been talking to scientists in the US who've got inventions coming out that absolutely, I mean, it's way beyond my brain to comprehend, but using light to make a substance that's bulletproof, I mean, to me it was making no sense whatsoever. But this is happening.
So there's hope in technology as well.
There's a lot of hope, but that's not going to work unless we all use our brains to think about our own environmental footprint. Every day we make some impact, mm-hmm. and we can choose what impact we make.
That was Dr. Jane Goodall, primatologist and anthropologist and founder of the Jane Goodall Institute and the Roots and Shoots program. So that was a conversation that I managed to have with her last Thursday when she was giving an address at the International Social Wellbeing Conference 2019, which was organized by the Employees Provident Fund. So if you'd like to find out more about her life and her work, you can always visit janegoodall.org. And if you'd like to join Jane Goodall's youth-led action program, which is Roots and Shoots, they do have a Malaysian chapter and you can visit rootsandshoots.my. If you miss any part of this interview or any previous Earth Matters interviews, you can search for the podcast on our BFM app, available on Google Play and the App Store, and also on Spotify. This has been Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.